Welcome back to the Bastionland podcast with me, Chris McDowell. This series is the audio commentary for Into the Odd Remastered. And each week, I'll be joined by a new guest to talk about Into the Odd and the games that it has inspired. Today, I'm joined by competent graphic designer Johan Noor. Hi, Johan.
Hi, Chris.
Nice to be here. For the last few series, I've given each guest a massively overblown like intro with loads of hype.
Okay.
So this time I'm downplaying it, and I'm just, you know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's me, so.
Yeah, you have some skill with graphic design.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, adequate. No, but cool.
for those who aren't familiar with your work somehow, would you like to give us a little bit of a background?
Yeah, sure. I started doing the first game book that I did was Simbarum way back, and then. I mean, obviously, the ones that I'm most known for, I guess, is Mörkborg, that I've done graphic design and art for, and I do all that kind of stuff. And I've done this weird book, Into the Odd Remastered, graphic design for that. And I'm currently working on a game called Cyborg as well. So that's what I'm up to right now.
Fantastic. And it's obviously... I'm going to get into the flattery straight away. It's been fantastic working with you on this project, but the downside of it is that people seemed more excited about having you involved than having me involved.
No, I wouldn't say that.
I'd see like a thread go up on Reddit, and all the replies would be like, "Oh, I'll buy anything by you." So,
okay, that's always fun to hear. I mean, I think some people were a bit. afraid when they saw my name in there because they thought that I was going to turn this into Mörkborg.
Yeah,
I saw that you had to like make that clear that no, this will not look like Mörkborg. Don't worry.
Yeah, I think that was the that was definitely something. But yeah, we'll get to that because before we get into sort of the work that we've done on this book, I need to give like a bit of a disclaimer that this is going to be quite a self-indulgent series. But it was a stretch goal for the Kickstarter. So anybody that has any problem with, you know, me talking about Into the Odd for six episodes, blame the Kickstarter backers because we hit that stretch goal. And this is what the people want, apparently.
And here we are, yeah.
So before working on this project, you were sort of loosely aware of Into the Odd, weren't you already?
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, well, loosely aware. I had run it a few times, and it was actually one of my, I would say, one of my top games for just some, if you want to pick something up and just play, that would be one of my first choices, absolutely. Right up there with, like, I don't know, Nave or... Mörkborg, probably. But no, sure. So, and I mean, I've been kind of inspired by Into the Odd in my own work as well. So, I mean, just look at how the introductory adventure for Mörkborg is formatted. That's stolen directly from Into the Odd. So, shamelessly just.
Yeah, it's the Ouroboros of, because, you know, you can take inspiration from Into the Odd, but that adventure at the back of Mörkborg, I think when we were speaking about formatting for this book, I think I basically said, like, can we just have it like that? Like, can we make, because it's so sort of clear and
yeah, it's like you say, it's like a continue, it's like it's a remix and a remix and a remix of everything. So
yeah. But no, I was loosely aware of that because, like you said, you're actually, I think, you're the first return guest on this podcast, technically.
Oh, I am. Yeah, that's true.
Because I've always said I'll have new people. So you've been on once with Pelle to talk about Mörkborg. Mm. And yeah, I think there we spoke about how there's a little bit of the kind of the cross-pollination of ideas there, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. And not just the formatting, but also like how it's written, and it's very minimal. And yeah, try to keep it short. And I've always been amazed at how you managed to do that with just a few words describe something, either if it's just in a dungeon description or in like the starter packages, which I think are pretty brilliant. So like you only have a few items and that can... explain who this person is, pretty much.
It all comes down to that similar sort of thing of We're not just going to go back and forth and praise each other's books all the program, but
the whole episode.
Similar to in Mortborg, you know, there's the famous page that's just the femur with a d6 damage.
Yeah,
right. Like, even though there's, I think that's literally all there is on that page, isn't there? I think. Mm-hmm. But that page tells you much more than just, you know, two words worth of information. It tells you a lot by having just that small bit of writing. But just for those of people who are jumping into this and that perhaps they backed the Kickstarter and this is their first sort of dip into one of my games, I wanted to give a really quick kind of really like 30-second, 1-minute background of how we kind of got to where we are with Into the Odd Remastered. So Into the Odd started, I started writing it, I think, around 2011, I think I started working on it. And it was released eventually through Lost Pages in 2014 as a sort of, I'm holding this very small pamphlet now, sort of 48-page thing. And some people seem to like it. So I then thought I could expand this into something big, like a big coffee table book that's still has a similar sort of feel, and that would become Electric Bastionland, which was the first game I sort of published myself via Kickstarter. And it was kind of after that was finished, and around that time was when I was also moving into full-time work on games. I was surprised how many people were still asking for Into the Odd stuff, because I'd kind of seen Electric Bastionland as kind of the not quite a replacement for the Into the Odd, but it was kind of like the next step of what I was doing with Into the Odd. So people were still asking for it, and it got me digging into sort of, well, why do people still like this little book when I've done a big book? And they are very different, even though the rules are the same, they are very different in how they're presented. But I sort of started beating around the idea of doing a remaster, and I think it was probably around that sort of time that I'd been speaking to Free League as well. Then it sort of like solidified into the idea of doing, rather than doing a new edition, to do a remaster. And that was kind of when sort of you came in, because I thought, well, if I'm going to remaster it, it can't just be, you know, tidying up the layout a little bit and getting some new art. I wanted to give it sort of a complete luxury overhaul. So I thought, you know, who do we go to? Who's the best in the business? So I approached you, and I think, to be honest, and this sounds like I'm making this up, but I genuinely, when I approached you, it was probably not long after you'd won like 15 Ennie Awards, and I thought, I will sort of try this idea out, and I'll run it past him, and I'm sure he'll have like a million different projects going on,
which I kind of had, but
yeah, not to say you didn't have any work going on,
but that's the funny thing. And like, I kind of had, but I couldn't say no to this. So it probably, like, in a lot of ways, it was probably a bad idea of me to do it time wise, but you know, it was a really good idea creatively, and you know, being able to be involved in this, because I see it as a big honor to have done this, because I think Into the Odd has been so influential to me. So with that said, you know, it was a lot of work, but it was really fun, and I'm super proud of what we've done.
So I want to sort of look at it from the start, from your point of view, because, you know, we had the original text, and we've talked about making it a remaster, and one of the few bits of guidance I've sort of had said from the start is like, it, you know, don't make it, I'm not asking you to make Mortborg again. What was your sort of approach to approaching a remaster rather than sort of making a new book from scratch?
I mean, in a way, it is a new book from scratch. Like, at least, visually it is, and design wise it is. But I think, like, I don't know, I think my job as a graphic designer is to approach every new project and sort of see, you know, what's the vibe in this one? What's the purpose to this project? You know, what does this project need, instead of just doing my thing? Because I could have just done another Mörkborg, but that would have been extremely wrong for this game. So I know we had a lot of talks about we did a Pinterest board with some inspiration, and we talked a bit about how we envisioned the book and everything. And even though we had that sort of starting point, I think it's important for a design and an art style to sort of evolve organically as well. So like, even if we have, I think if you look at our Pinterest board now, it doesn't align super much to the finished product because it changes over time. But I don't know. I think it took a while for me to find the style that we have now, but once it clicked, it was coming along quite nicely.
Yeah, I think the one thing that we sort of had that we settled on quite early on was this idea of making it look almost like a found book. Like it was almost like it was an artifact. So that's where we sort of landed on the idea of using the public domain, using the public domain artwork, but really kind of chopping it up and warping it and making it. So, I mean, the mood that I had in mind, which I think we've landed on really well, is this that feeling you get when you're in like a secondhand bookshop and you find something really weird. And you're sort of looking through it and you're like, well, what's this book? It's like some book from 100 years ago and you don't quite get what it is. I wanted to sort of capture that. And funny enough, I was watching a read through today and people were saying that, like, because there's a lot of kind of charts and like notes and diagrams. Mm. And it kind of looks like, the art is trying to like explain stuff that can't be explained because it's just weird.
And I mean, that's kind of the idea that I have, because I see this, I mean, my vision of this game, you know, my perspective of it is that you play these basically city people who are delving into a weird world, right? And you try to understand it and you try to map it out, and but you can't really because it's so alien. So the graphic design and the typography and the whole packaging of the book is very like almost academic in a way, but the art is the weird part and the odd part, and where it sort of it's like this collage style things that you could encounter in this odd world, but it's not very clear exactly what it is.
And from like a purely self-indulgent point of view as well, it was the thing that I liked, and I don't know if anybody else would have picked up on this, is when I first started making Into the Odd, over 10 years ago now.
Yeah,
I was using like OpenOffice Writer or whatever to do the layout and just like putting free PDFs out on Google+ to see who would come and play it. And the artwork I was using there was, I was using a lot of public domain art, like, you know, like everyone, those same like Gustave Doré, art pieces you see in like every free RPG, like I've done my time with them. But then I went through a bit of a phase of just like plugging them into like free Photoshop software and just like using the tools really in a really blunt way to basically do like a really amateur version of what you've done here, where you sort of have like that blend of what's clearly real art from, you know, 19th or 18th century.
Yeah.
And then just that weird warping thing where it kind of makes it's even more unsettling than creating a new piece of art, because you've got that.
Yeah, and I think one important part of the making art like this is that you don't lock it down to a certain time period, because it becomes too. I think that was one of the reasons why I wanted to go away a bit from that sort of. I learned a new word, this skeuomorphic thing, where this book it actually looks like a book in the world or from a certain time period, because that would have dated it so much. So like if you have these public domain images from a time period and then you add something completely, you know, out of context to it, then it could become weird and it could become even more, you know, fantastical. So that's why there's a bunch of these like geometrical shapes and just strange, undescribable things as well in these arts. So I think, that kind of works.
It's interesting because with this one, after doing Electric Bastion, where I used a single artist, I thought for this one, I definitely want to use just one person again for all of the artwork. And it's interesting that we have and we haven't, because it's all your artwork, and you know, making it into a collage is, you know, just as much work as making a new piece of art, I can imagine, in certain ways. And but it does feel like this kind of weird like mix. It's like a weird mix, but it's also consistent, if that makes sense.
There's a certain style to the collage, so that makes sense, absolutely. But I mean, how was your thoughts on making a revision versus a new edition, like or a remaster versus a new edition? Like, what would you say the main difference is?
Well, it was really interesting because when i when I did Electric Bastion Land, I was doing a similar sort of thing where I was beating around the bush a bit and saying, well, it's not a new edition of Into the Odd, it's a different thing. So I was using the same rules and the same setting, but sort of advanced, sort of vaguely into the future, and a different way of presenting the game. So with that, I was trying to sort of make that very much its own standalone thing. But with coming back to this one, the temptation was to sort of completely rewrite it. But I thought, I was thinking like, who's this for? What's the purpose of this? And the purpose of this is to kind of honor the original game, really, which sounds very pretentious and very kind of self-important. But this was coming from like what people were asking me for. Like people were asking for something based around the original Into the Odd. And I didn't want to then say, oh yeah, okay, I'll do a new Into the Odd and then go and change everything that people liked about Into the Odd. Because if they want the next step of Into the Odd from my own perspective, that's Electric Bastion Land. But I wanted this to be the best version of that original that I could do. So it was really, I tried to be very sort of gentle in terms of my approach to changing things or adding things that I think that the biggest addition, as you sort of know, because I think this is probably one of the most difficult bits for you to do, was the expanding the Iron Coral and the adventure, because I thought that's a good safe thing. No one's going to complain that there's, you know, two more levels to the dungeon. But people might complain if you just put in like one little rule. People might think. And you know, I don't think you should try and write games for other people necessarily, but I wanted to honor the original game. And I think just doing more content to use with the game was sort of the pitch that I had for myself, really. It was an interesting approach. And it's so different to what I normally do, because I'm always sort of thinking about the next project and always trying to do. I'm very good at starting projects and not necessarily finishing them. Yeah. So this was kind of like going back and finishing your projects all over again. So it was surprisingly tough going, actually.
Would you say that it's kind of like it's called Ashcan situation, where like the first one that you released is sort of like a pre-1.0 version, and this is like the full release of the game?
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, I don't want to downplay the original, because that was the first, you know, it was, I still remember it was such an amazing feeling to see a book that had my name on it, you know, even if it was just a paperback,
but it's a 48 classic,
page so. Thing. Yeah. Yeah. And, it was, I remember, you know, when we launched that game, Paolo at Lost Pages was sort of telling me when the sales were coming in, he was like, oh, we sold 6 copies. And I was like, this is incredible. Like, I can't believe 6 people have bought this book. So I don't want to like downplay that, and I didn't have some grand plan that I was thinking, oh, in 10 years time I'm going to release an incredible hardback version of this book. That game was sort of that book was definitely like, it was the perfect book for me to make at that time. I realize I'm very fortunate now to be able to do this kind of project, but I think if at the risk of closing sort of doors, I think I would call this like Into the Odd, like the definitive version of Into the Odd, I guess. Yeah. Like, I think it's sort of fulfilling the original sort of promise of that book, certainly.
Yeah, awesome.
So in terms of like, we've spoken a little bit about your sort of visual inspiration for the book. Our Pinterest board, I just remember there was a lot of like esoteric stuff.
Yeah.
And like, because Electric Bastion Land presented the world in such a different way, I kind of wanted to look back at what was different about Into the Odd. And that kind of, because it's sort of set in it's implied to be sort of an earlier time period. Mm. So it's a bit, things are a bit sort of more mystical compared to in Electric Bastion Land, things are a bit more matter of fact and kind of quirky. It's like, oh yeah, there's aliens. Yeah. Like they're just here. They're just some people. Whereas here I wanted the sort of those elements to be very kind of mysterious, and for there to be lots of kind of, like you said about the scientific charts and geometry and stuff, people trying to like make sense of these things. But were there any sort of particular sources that you remember really, really inspiring you for this?
No, I mean,
sort of the look of this.
Just digging through the public domain libraries of the museums was my big inspiration source. Because that, I mean, that's a lot of work to do that, to find all these different pieces, but still you end up with so much more than you can use. So
it's weird because people ask me all the time, they say like, oh, what's your biggest like inspiration for this setting? And I don't like really have one.
No,
it's weird because even though it feels quite specific, it also feels quite broad and quite open. So it's...
Yeah, but I think that the odd here is so undefined in a way. And it's it's vague. What exactly what it is, but it's
much more inspired by this is going to sound extremely pretentious, but it's more inspired by like a feeling rather than like another source of like fiction or something.
No, but that
like,
makes sense. Sure.
Yeah. It's like I said about that finding a weird book. It's more inspired by that than it is by any particular book that I've read.
Yeah.
As you sort of worked through this book, you've said it was much more work than you anticipated, which we've discussed.
No, it was. Previously. But,
So what was the main, so were there any main difficulties that you're happy to talk about with
that? No, I think, as you mentioned, I think the adventure is quite a big beast that I didn't really anticipate it because, and also I kind of bloated it in a way because in the first version, the whole adventure is what, 5 pages or something. But with the new, but with the new design, everything, there's so much more like white space and there's so much more art and everything. So it just takes up more pages. And especially since you added 2 more levels and a bunch of like smaller dungeons and everything, that was fun as well. And I don't know, it kind of took me a while to find a way to format the adventure because even though it's based on the first Into the Odd and Rot Black Sludge from Mirkbori, the formatting and everything, we added some tweaks. We added the directions as arrows instead, and everything is all the page and room references are hyperlinked in the PDF, and all these things, even though small, they take a lot of time to do. And I said this before, I don't work very smart. I work very manually, and I do everything like every instance of these things by hand. So I'm getting very technical here, but there was a lot of work, but I think it was worth it. And also, obviously it was, but what else? No, I mean, just making all the artworks were really fun as well to just take all these photos and illustrations and mash them together into what they are now.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess you're sort of known for using public domain stuff with Mortborg had obviously some original artwork in it as well.
Yeah.
But, say sort of half and half roughly. Do you feel like you're done with public domain? are you sick of it after this project?
No, not really. But I think it's fun to have found a style of artwork that at least I have never seen before, or I've never done before, this sort of collage thing, but that was fun. And I don't know, you don't see like we use some photos in this as part of the artwork, and I don't think you see that very often in books. It has sort of a stigmatized standing in role-playing game book design for some reason. I don't know why. I think it's something that more games should use. But
yeah, there's the big one that stands out is the on the rolling a character page.
Yeah,
like the first sort of look you get of like a sort of who might be your character is a photo.
Yeah,
and it's really strange to see that outside of sort of even in sort of modern games, really, I don't think you really see that all that often. So it's
no, there's usually like digital artworks in every game, and I think this in a way makes it more real. But there's also I mean, the strength of illustrations versus photos is obviously that you can much more easier, identify with an illustration in a way because you can add your own sort of personality to it. But I feel like this is, something happened. It sort of painted this world as more real in a way, even though it's strange and unreal. Now I'm getting pretentious, but,
No, absolutely.
That was fun, but... I think I'm especially, I mean, this wasn't even the question, but I'm especially proud of the cover as well, because that doesn't look like anything I've done before, and it's so different in style and approach from Mörk Borg, which I'm mostly known for now. So it's fun to show some range, I think.
Yeah, when that I remember you sending me like the first draft of that, and I was sort of like, took 30 seconds of looking at it to think like, do I like this, or is this too weird?
But it was different then as well, the first version.
I mean, the fact that I had to think that, that's what sort of tipped me over the edge, and I was like, well, no, the whole point is I want this to look different to other RPG books. And I haven't seen the physical book yet, we're sort of waiting on them, but I think it's going to look really good in a physical form.
I do hope, but, so
I've had so much good feedback on the cover. Although that does remind me that I remember when we were sort of in a real phase of madness early on, and we were discussing ideas for the cover. You were talking about something like having a rotating wheel on the cover.
Yeah, that was one of the ideas, to have like I don't know, like a big cog wheel that you
like
could,
a big D20 wheel you can spin.
Yeah, that you could actually spin, like physically spin on top on the book.
If we'd put that as the stretch goal for like a million, then maybe we would have got there.
I think it's going to be really fun to see the whole like cloth spine and everything that we have.
Yeah
So we'll see. It's a lot of moving parts when you print these things, and there's a lot that can go wrong, so we'll see what happens. Hopefully nothing.
Don't say that. Okay, that's that's the last thing we want to hear.
No, I'm always preparing myself for catastrophic failure when I'm doing these things.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I think so with Electric Bastion Land, I was sort of publishing that myself. The risk was even greater because I was sort of, you know, there was no one to help me sort of with any problems like that, really. With this one, at least I can blame you when it all goes wrong.
Yeah, it's absolutely. No, but I'm quite confident that it will be fine. Yeah. I'll
throw you under the bus.
Yeah, please.
Now, I did leave a section in here because it's something that people have already asked me about this.
Oh, okay.
And I thought if we needed to fill some time on this podcast, I could go into the section that I just have as typeface nerd stuff.
Uh-oh. How long do we have?
Well, I know that you're the obviously the typeface guy, and how many did you use in Mottbook?
Oh, it's over 100, but that was a typographical experiment. So
So with this one, it's much more restrained. How do you remember how many?
There's four of them. Yeah, but I mean, and that's the thing, when I do very occasionally, but I have like taught graphic design, and when I do that, I always tell the students that you should stick to like 2 to 4 typefaces in a project, because you want to keep it like coherent, and find like three to four typefaces that sort of does the work together and works together. So, but you know, Mörk Borg was it's an extreme example of just breaking all those rules, but here there are four of them, and yeah, I mean, I can get nerdy here. No worries.
Do you want to give some shout outs for all the typeface fans that want to know what these four?
Sure, absolutely. The four ones, the big one for the main like headlines, the large headlines, is called Ferrome. I'm not sure exactly what foundry it is, but it's this very elegant, like almost editorial typeface. It looks like it could be on a fashion magazine. And that's the one that's in the title as well on the cover. And I kind of wanted that because it represents in a way this, you know, the city people that you portray in this game, and their world in a way. And it also pairs very well to the body copy typeface, which is a Swedish serif font called Ivar text. And that is by a small foundry called Letters from Sweden. And I think it's their version of Times New Roman. It's like their modernized version of Times New Roman.
Ah, okay.
So it's very, it's made for like newspapers, and to be very easy to read, and perfect for book design, really. And it also, I have a very small, very nerdy anecdote from this, because there are there are some game terms and stuff that are in small caps that we have here.
Yes. Yeah.
And I noticed when I was working with this that the italic version of this typeface didn't have small caps for some reason. They just weren't there. So I had to like email the foundry and ask them about this. why? And they had like an unfinished beta version of an updated, you know, version of this typeface that had these italic small caps letters that they sent me. So I think this is probably the first product to ever use that italic small caps. Very nerdy.
Amazing.
Yeah, but that's something you can put on the cover. So that's Ivar Text, and that's the second one. And the third one is, it's called Mohica, I think, which is the subheader typeface. This kind of rough, or almost like kind of industrial looking typeface, something you could see on like an advertisement from the 19th century or something. And that's also like to remind ourselves that this world, or this city Bastion, is an industrial city as well. You have that sort of world as well. So those three kind of represent the player characters and their home turf. But the fourth one is the one called Ribond Grotesque, which is the typeface that we use for fact text and stat blocks and everything. And that's sort of like, at a first glance, it's a pretty regular, like Helvetica-like sans serif, but each letter, or most of the letters, have all these small little quirks, and some of the lines are a bit exaggerated, and some of the shapes are a bit like extreme. So there's like something wrong with each letter, which could, in a, again, very pretentious way here, represent the descent into the odd, or the, you know, and the passageway to this weird world that you have. So those are the kind of four typefaces that we use.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that typography is also a way to visualize a game world, or to, you know, communicate a theme of a game. So
100%. Yeah. I think I'm not a typeface nerd on your level. I wish I were. It's something I keep meaning to like read more about. But with Electric Bastionland, I feel like I used Gil Sans.
Yeah.
For everything. And I think, again, that extreme, it might seem like that was just because it was my first professional layout at work and I wanted to keep it simple, but I think it's the kind of city where I imagine they would have like a standardized font that this some borough would declare that is the font for everything. And
yeah, and it's very it's very like city like and very British as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you spend any time in London, obviously you see lots of versions of Gil Sans used for lots of things like the Underground and so on. So it's it's a really interesting way of getting the setting across. And the amount of time, the problem now is whenever I start a new document in like the layout software, I spend too long. Even before I've got anything written, I spend too long thinking, what's the typeface going to be for this?
but that's a problem. I mean, I know that.
Yeah.
For sure. But I think a few of these, at least two of these, were like typefaces that was just love on first sight with me. So when I just, I tend to go window shopping in, you know, typeface pages and foundries, homepages and everything. And when I found these typefaces that stumble upon them that I just love, I buy them without even thinking of like what I'm going to use them for. And so I have like a little collection of typefaces that I just have to use at some point. And you know, all of a sudden you have this project where they're just perfect and there's a perfect match for it. So yeah, I'm just glad that I got to use these for once.
Were there any other sort of big surprises or highlights for you in the finished book when you sort of, because we're just to give a bit of context, we're hopefully done with it now. It's gone off to the print house and we're hopefully kind of done with it now. But when you sort of step back and look at it, was there anything that leapt out at you?
I think one thing that surprised me was how big the Odd Pendium was. in this this thing.
Well, yeah.
It's like a third of the book with just extra, you know, content and extra tables and play, you know. So that's pretty cool to see that.
Yeah, it's I always forget about that section because I think at the time that I did Into the Art originally, it was one of the bigger sets of random tables to have at the back of the book. Definitely, mm-hmm. I think there were lots of games that use random tables, but having them all in this sort of almost like no context, just a big list, a big section of tables. Yeah, that wasn't something I'd seen so much at the time. Yeah,
that's good. But
hopefully, one of the easier sections to lay out, at least.
No, absolutely. and I kind of like that they're just the tables and nothing else. Like they're super easy to reference and super easy to you know work your way around. And I also dig that there are like optional classes and everything in there. So if you ever get bored with the starter packages, you have a bunch of new ones and a bunch of other optional ways to play, you create your character.
Well, I kind of wanted that to be, I kind of wanted to have that really weird stuff in there. Like there's, like you said, there's the sort of the alternative character groups. I wanted that to give kind of permission for people to do different things with the game. It's like, if you don't want to run it like from the book, you can in the Unhumans section, there's kind of like what are essentially like elves and dwarves.
Yeah, yeah,
if you really want to do this, you can do it. Like, and here's how you might do it. But the reasoning behind the Odpendium originally was I had a lot of feedback about how it was slightly strange that the sample adventure isn't set in Bastion, because you know Bastion is the only city that matters. It's the center of the setting. So people would ask me like, well, why is it not in Bastion? And I would go on to sort of explore that in Electric Bastion Land more. But in this sort of iteration, I wanted, like you say, I wanted the characters to feel like a sense of connection to Bastion, but maybe not sort of start the game there. So you start the game in the adventure that's going on outside. So these tables were kind of just like, if you want the city of Bastion, it exists in these tables. Like a list of occupations is, you know, that's your cast. And then there's a table for like what's in this street. So whatever you roll, that's your city. And what's the quickest route across town. And I wanted it to sort of almost come into existence as you played the game, sort of almost procedurally, rather than me include a big map of Bastion at the back of the book and say, well, here's an adventure that's set in Bastion and here's a map.
But I mean, all these things on these tables, they are the map of Bastion in a way.
Yeah,
like if you read it top to bottom, you know you get a good idea of what the city is about. So
yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And also I think it's fun that there are a bunch of small mini dungeons that you could either have as part of the hex crawl thing, or you can just run them as one shots. What's that the idea?
One pages. Yeah, I mean, this is a project I'm probably never going to do, but I always wanted to make a sort of sandbox adventure that was. Have you played like Breath of the Wild?
A bit.
So the same idea of having like a big sort of overworld, and then the dungeons that exist in the world are very small. So you sort of in a single game session, you might jump in and do like two or three dungeons in a single session that are sort of these always presented on like one page each.
Yeah.
And there's lots of people that do that already, but I always wanted to sort of try and do it myself. So this was kind of a way of dipping into that, really, where I wanted there to be things to find in the Fallen Marsh, sort of the wilderness around the dungeon, because previously in Into the Odd, the Fallen Marsh was just kind of there to be the place that you walked through after doing the Iron Claw. You kind of walked through there to get to Hope's End, and then you get on a boat and go to Bastion, and you're kind of done with this region. But I thought, well, how do I get people to sort of hang around this area a bit more and actually go and explore it? So
There's a lot of small like adventure hooks and stuff in there, so I think you can get a lot of hours from this.
I tried to just like put little hooks everywhere that connected things together and had little bits of storytelling. And I was quite resistant to doing stretch goals originally, but one of the stretch goals that came out of this project was the I'm trying to find the page now. The rumors of the marsh. Let me find it.
Yeah, and there's also the people or the boats that come to Hope's End. The Marsh Myths is on the page 100.
Ah, the March Myths. Yes, I'm on it. So, the March Myths are sort of 12 little myths that anyone you meet in the Marsh will tell you one of them. They'll find like some way to tell you this like scary story basically about the Marsh normally. And each of them kind of points you towards somewhere. So some of them are things that already existed in the Marsh, but they just didn't have a hook. It was just things that you might stumble across.
Yeah.
But now it's going to actually encourage people to go out and do it. And yes, same with the... same with the echoes of the Iron Coral, where each time you go back to the Iron Coral, it's slightly different. And each time you go to Hope's End, there's different ships in the dock. I just wanted to give a bit more life into this sandbox so that you could have like a campaign in here, essentially. It's not just a case of somewhere you walk through before you get to the rest of the game.
Yeah, and it's also a good inspiration for people to create their own stuff and to make their own content for it, just to show like, oh, you can make these things, or it's very easy.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is as well, like I really wanted to, like, part of the reason that you've said about sort of how I write things quite short and like to the point, and part of that is because that's the style that I like, but I also want, I feel like people often worry too much about preparing a game, and they think they need to create some giant, you know, background and everything needs to match up perfectly. But really, if you just create a few little interesting bits and pieces and scatter them around and connect them together, often like things kind of fall into place once you actually get it to the table. And I wanted to kind of show that, you know, you can do that with this system and it'll work.
And it's so much easier, I think, to run something that it's built that way. I realized that when I first ran the Iron Corral, and it's just like three sentences per room, and it just worked at the table. I could pretty much read the entirety of the room then and there, and people would pick up on it and play on whatever they heard. So
it's kind of a response to the idea of the classic thing is like the box text that you would get in like some D&D adventures, where like someone was asking recently about like advice for a person who was running D&D for the first time, and saying like, I heard someone say, oh, get something with box text, because then you can, they can just read the box text to the players and it does the describing for them. But the problem is then the players are going to ask you a question and you're not going to have the answer in front of you, and you're going to panic. So if all you have is some bullet points, like I'm just looking at a room now, I've got like lumpy metallic walls, meaty chunks, symbols on the wall, and then there's a passageway and a door. You've got to, from the very first room, players are going to ask something that you don't have the answer on the page. They're going to say like, well, how big are these chunks on the ground? And you're going to have to start making stuff up. And it's the most valuable skill you can have in running the game, is making stuff up and answering questions that you don't have the answer to. It's kind of the whole game.
that's what it is. So, it's also easier to make up stuff, you know, as you go. If you have it very short, because as you said, if you run these adventures with box text, the second you invent something of your own, then they're gonna know that, oh, this is outside of the
exactly.
So that's good. And also a funny thing, or like something that I realized you could do, was this magic with the PDF where you could attach files to it. Something I've never done before.
from the sounds of the Kickstarter comments, I think there's lots of people who haven't done it before.
And that's literally just a bonus thing. So I recommend you to also have it on the side. But,
I have posted it somewhere else as well, so it is available. Yeah, it's technology that's never been used before, and probably will never be used again.
Yeah. So inside the PDF, there's a little file that has the character sheet embedded into it, so you never have to worry about where your character sheets are. So have it in there.
That's it.
Perfect.
Yeah. You know, as I've said, obviously it's been fantastic working with you on this, and thanks for coming on to the commentary.
Thank you for having me on this project as well. I mean,
oh, no problem at all. It's been an honor, absolutely. And For those people who do want to find out more about the other things that you're working on, where can they do that?
Oh, yeah. I think that you should follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter. Twitter is probably the best way to find me, but just follow Stockholm Cartel or Mörkborg. You know, you'll figure it out.
Twitter is never the best way, I should say.
No.
That's my disclaimer. but yeah, it's a necessary evil to stay in touch with some cool people like Johan. So thank you again, and thank you to everyone out there for listening. And as always, you can keep up to date with everything Bastionland at bastionland.com, where there are links to the Discord server, Twitch and YouTube channels, and to Patreon, where you can help to support everything that I do. And you can join me next week, where I'll be welcoming another guest to talk about Into the Odd. Goodbye for now.